This is the Phillies panel. Our moderator today is Dan Baker, the PA announcer for the Phillies. Dan has been with the Phillies as a PA announcer for 42 years, so he knows the game. And he's also kind of this wonderful voice. He's a former colleague of mine at Drexel University, and we see him often in events that he does around town with baseball. Now, he's got a great voice, and I think it'll be obvious to you after a few seconds. I always like to say that he could take a player like Jimmy Rollins and with his voice turn him into somebody who looks like Jim Thome, because he's got that ability to do that. So without further ado, let me just introduce Dan Baker, who will introduce the panelists and get started with the committee. Dan?
Thank you. Thank you, Dick. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The Philadelphia Phillies welcome you to Citizens Bank Park, where tonight the Phillies host the San Francisco Giants in National League Baseball. Well, for all of you from out of town, welcome to Philadelphia. Do we have any native Philadelphians here? I'm born and raised, and I love this city with all my heart, as I do this baseball team and these players. And it's my pleasure this afternoon to MC a panel discussion with three Phillies postseason heroes. Let me tell you who they are. Seated closest to me is Dickie Knowles. In 1980, 97 years after the Phillies were born, 1883, the Phillies still had not won a World Series championship. After all, until that time, the Phillies had only made two World Series appearances. And I know we have a lot of experts out here. So Dick or Gary or Brad, if I make a mistake, if I get a wrong statistic or year, these guys will know it. But of course, the Phillies went to the World Series in 1915 and lost to the Red Sox in close games. And they were swept by the Yankees in 1950. The Whiz Kids were, and they were also very close games. Well, the Phillies made it back to the World Series in 1980. They had a wonderful team. Many people think that was like the first golden era of Phillies baseball, beginning in the mid-70s. And then maybe the best ever NLCS, the Phillies and the Houston Astros. Remember that one? Oh, man, that was something. So the Phillies go into the World Series versus the Kansas City Royals. And they win the first two games in Philadelphia. It looks like we're off to a good start. But then, when we get to Kansas City, those Royals, a prolific offensive team, start hitting. And man, oh man, for all of us native Philadelphians who had our hearts set on our first World Series championship, things were beginning to look a little precarious. But fortunately, there was a deciding moment, in my view and in many others' view, in the 1980 World Series that kept momentum on the Phillies' side. It was the Phillies' pitcher's willingness to throw inside and keep those Royals batters loose, particularly one individual. Phillies pitcher number 48, Dickie Knowles. Now, and I'm going to have Dickie tell you about, that high and inside pitch to George Brett in just a moment. The next member of our panel, seated in the middle, and the offensive player of the panel, in 1973, he was the Rookie of the Year with the San Francisco Giants. And he could hit for average, he could hit for power, and he is a natural leader. The Phillies were lucky enough to get Gary in the early 80s, and in 1983, the Phillies played 500 ball for most of the year, if you recall. But then, in September, they went on a tear, 22-7, and the Phillies went into the World Series, and of course, to get there, they had to face the Los Angeles Dodgers in the NLCS. Now, Gary, you could correct me. I might be wrong about this, but I think during the regular season, the Dodgers may have won like 8 of 10 or something, regular season meetings.
11 out of 12.
11 out of 12, even worse. But Gary Matthews was not going to let that happen in the NLCS. He had a couple of home runs. He was as hot as a firecracker. And he was voted the most valuable player in the 1983 National League Championship Series. Left fielder number 34, Gary Matthews. So that's 1980, 1983, and on the end, he's being honored tonight as he will officially retire as a Philadelphia Philly at 6:45 this evening prior to the start of the Phillies-Giants game. He had the perfect season in 2008. As the Phillies won their second World Series, he did such a good job as a closer that year that he earned the nickname Lights Out, and he certainly was. 48 save opportunities in the regular and postseason, 48 saves for the last member of our panel. Each of these three guys, besides being a great athlete and a great Philly, is a great gentleman. It's a distinction that they certainly all share. The last member of our panel, one of the top closers in Philly's history, of course he had a pretty good career with Houston as well, would you please welcome Philly's pitcher number 54, Brad Lidge. Three heroes. Now, we're going to hear from each of these Phillies stars, these postseason heroes, starting with Dickie Knowles. Dickie, would you please set the scene for us? We're in Kansas City, Missouri. The Phillies won the first couple, and then the Royals start coming on strong. Let's get to that moment where you threw high and tight to George Brett. But please share with all of these wonderful attendees at the Sabre Convention what the circumstances were and why that pitch was so crucial to Philly's success.
Well, you know, Dan, first of all, it is a pleasure to be here with all you other baseball fans, and not only baseball fans, Sarge calls them baseball people. And I'm up here with a couple of good baseball guys. But we were in the best, maybe if it wasn't the greatest postseason as far as playoffs is concerned, it has to be one of the top three or four or five when we played the Houston Astros. And we'd been through that, so we'd been through some pretty good baseball. Most of us at that time, myself included, we didn't understand it on that ball club. Maybe Lenzinski and maybe Boa did. But most of us young guys didn't understand the whole negative history with Philadelphia Philly losing baseball, because when we joined the Phillies, all they did was win. So when we got into the 80 playoffs, we started to feel it a little bit of people saying, here, they're going to choke again, 76, 77, 78. So when we won, it took a lot of pressure off people. Now we go in to play Kansas City, and it almost became like a circus, like a Hollywood type of an event. And you've seen Tug McGraw walking around with Quisenberry and a whole lot of different things going on. Then the game started, and it got a little rough. We won the first couple games, like you said, Dan. Then we go to Kansas City. And to me, what happened in that game was a little bit more than a knockdown pitch, because if you go back and you watch that game in the first inning, Larry Christensen is getting bombed. He's out on the mound, and he's getting hit. The first guy comes up, I believe it was Willie Wilson, and he gets on first base. I don't know if it was a walk or single, but Larry goes to pick him off, throws it away. He runs to third. The next guy may have made an out. I think it was the only out he got, Frank White. But then George Brett hits a triple, and then Willie Mays Akins hits one that was about 480 feet, and then McCray hits one off the top of the wall. Otis hits one off the top of the wall. Somebody else drives one off the wall. Next thing you know, bases are loaded, and they're up 4-0, and they bring me in. And the interesting thing about that was me and Kevin Sauché, and you were talking about Sauché earlier, so you know he's a nut, the guy from Houston over there who we used to break his cowbell all the time. But Sauché is a total bona fide nut. He's crazy. So when the bell rang in the telephone, me and Sauché hadn't pitched in a World Series, and we were up every game in the playoffs, and so we both ran to the pitcher's mound and started throwing, and the phone rang again, and Dallas Green had called down, and Irish answered the phone. Our bullpen coach, Mike Ryan, he said, "Are you guys ready?" I went, "I am." And Saul says, "He hadn't thrown a pitch yet." So I had thrown about three by the time Dallas went out to the mound. I got five total pitches in, and I'm in a game with the bases loaded. And I went 3-0 on the first hitter, which was Willie Wilson. They had batted around. Then I threw a strike. He swung at a ball and grounded out, and I covered first, and the inning was over. So we come into the dugout, and we're looking up, and Kansas City goes back out to hit again, and I'm pitching. And I believe it was the first one that really irritated our ball club was Hal McCray hit a ground ball single up the middle, just a little 90 hopper. And as he hit it up the middle, Gary Matthews fills it in center field on one knee and lobbed it back in. And McCray was a very aggressive heads-up player. He never stopped and ran into second and made it stretch the single into a double. But when he slid, he did a pop-up slide and came up on Manny Trio's glove, and he had his fist up in the air like this, like, yeah, and the stadium was erupted again. It was going crazy, and he wouldn't get off his glove. And he was standing on Manny's glove, and Manny had caught the ball and dove. So I walked to second base. And I told him, I said, if you don't get off his glove, I'm going to hit you in the head. So Hal McCray's the guy that I was going to hit in the head in the beginning. I said, if you don't get off of his glove, I'm going to hit you in the head. And Hal McCray looked at me and just as calmly could be and said, hey, called me a boy. He said, hey, boy, you want to show me? I'm from Missouri. And I started to walk back to the dugout, you know, to the mound. I turned around and said, that was pretty cool. You know, we are in Kansas City. It took me that long to figure that out. Then a little bit later in the game, McCray comes up, which is the second inning. McCray comes up off of me a little bit earlier in the game, should I say. Let's get to that point first, because this is probably the biggest motivating factor in why the pitch happened. Before McCray hits his ball, Willie Mays Akins came up in the second inning, homered in the first, which was his third in the series, and now with a 3-1 count, I threw him a curveball, and he hits one off me. Second inning. First inning, homer, second inning. And when he hit it, I wasn't the type of pitcher that cared about giving up home runs. I never threw at guys for hitting home runs because if they hit home runs and it was a long way, I watched it because I always would turn around and go, I wish I could hit one that far. I ain't kidding you, Sarge. I love watching them. If I'm going to give it up, Brad, might as well give up a long one, right? So he hit one, and I'm watching it, and I go, that's going to leave the stadium. And it came pretty close. It hit the back wall. But the problem was when I turned around, Willie was still standing in the batter's box. So I walked to home plate, and I said, hey, Willie, you need to run. And he still wasn't running. And then finally flips his bat, takes a couple steps, and I said, hey, I'm going to hit you right in your head. Now, that's the first guy I said I was going to hit in the head. And he ran around the bases really, 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 really slow. So I went to home plate and let him know again, when you come up next time, I'm going to hit you. So then I went back to the mound, and then that's when Hal McCray hits his little ground ball. So I've told two guys I'm going to hit them in the head. And then I start to pitch pretty good. And you know what kills me about this game? Sometimes I wish I wouldn't have thrown it, Brett, but I'm glad I did. I wish we'd have came back and won the game, because if Dallas Green would have left me in that ball game, I think I'd have struck out 13 or 14 guys. I was throwing hard that day. They were swinging and missing. They couldn't come close to hitting it after I got settled in. And I was striking out. I struck out like 5 out of 6 or 7 guys at one point. I don't remember. But all I know is I was throwing a lot of good fastballs by them, and they had no chance. And now we get to the fourth inning, and George Brett comes up. And when Brett walked into the dugout, I looked and seen Willie Mays Akins on deck. And I thought, okay, once I get Brett out, I'm going to drill this guy. So Brett comes up, and the first fastball I threw him, if you recall that year, he hit one off Gossage in the playoffs in the upper deck on 99-mile-an-hour fastball. And Booney's calling everything but fastballs, and I'm going, no, I'm throwing a fastball. I threw a fastball right by him. He swung and missed it. I threw another one. We had 4 none sitting on the end of the dugout by our visiting dugout over there at third base. Next fastball I threw, he hit a line drive that like to kill him, went right in between all of them. So he swung late on that one. So I got no balls and 2 strikes on him. And he's taking a lot of time to get in the box. And he's looking at Smitty. He's down there talking to Smitty, like, you know, laughing with Smitty and looking at his bat like it had a hole in it. I said, hey, George, if you don't get in the box, I'm going to hit you. So George got in the box, and he kind of gave me a dirty look. And I thank God to this day. I would never throw at anybody's head. I would never preach that. But I threw right at the man's head. And I thank God that I missed him. And if you recall the pitch, he's very acrobatic. He flipped up, and the ball was coming right at his face. I learned later on after the game, Tom Seaver told me it was the slowest pitch I threw. He said I was throwing anywhere from 94 to 95 early in the game, and by the late water ball game, I was throwing everything about 95, 96. That one, he said, was 90 miles an hour. So I thank God for that, because if it had been 95, I would have hit him. But when he hit the ground, I remember it just like 5 minutes ago, Dan. He hit the ground, and the stadium went quiet. And then it just erupted into a bunch of boos. Pete Rose is the guy that made the pitch. And Sarge will tell you, Rose never missed an opportunity to make something happen in his favor. So Rose ran in by me because Fry ran out to the umpire and said, stop it right now, stop it right now. He's throwing at him. And then there I can hear Pete Rose in his ear going, how do you know he's throwing at him? So I knew Rose was coming to my defense. Then the umpire's coming out to get me, and Rose is telling Jim Fry, get off the field. And Jim Fry turns around. He goes, he wasn't throwing at him. And Fry goes, how do you know? He said, because I know him. If he was throwing at him, it hit him. So then after that, Fry didn't know what to say. And then I looked over, and every one of their players were looking at me, and they had their hands around their neck, and they were saying they were going to hit me. I go, I don't even hit. You know, it's a DH. But and they were telling me they were going to kick my rear end. And Rose said, hey, just pitch your own ball game. If you want to hit any of those guys, go right ahead. They all sat down very quietly. So I imagine the pitch did have, you know, it took me a long time. I had dinner with Brett this year, opening day, and it took 30 years for him to ask me if I really threw at him. And I said, yeah. Of course, it took two bottles of wine for him to get up the courage to ask me that, but that's okay. Then he walked over to me. He goes, did you really throw at me? And I went, yeah. And he went, yes, I love it. And then about 5 minutes later, he said, you better be glad I didn't get a hit. But that's the most important thing. When you knock somebody down, you better not give them a good pitch to hit. And I threw a slider to him, and that's all he talked about for the next 2 hours. That might have been the best slider I've ever seen in my life. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, that slider was nasty. He said, I went to the American League. You got traded over here, and I thought two things. I'm going to hit a line drive off your head and get you back. And I told my whole club, you're getting ready to face the nastiest slider ever. And after every slider you threw him, they came back and said, that ain't a very good slider. I forgot to tell him I'd lost a little bit on a barroom brawl after that. So that's the pitch, Dan. That's the kind of way it worked out. And I thank God that people think it may have had an impact on the World Series.
Number 48, Kiki Knoll. Is Bob Bloss here today? Philadelphia area writer and author, Bob Bloss. He told me he was going to be here. I saw him at the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame, and he had a martini with about six olives in it. I figured it wasn't his first. And I said, boy, you've been enjoying yourself, haven't you, with all of those olives? He said, well, my doctor told me to make sure I eat plenty of green vegetables. Our next speaker is the Sarge, and he was a one-man wrecking crew in 1983. Gary, could you tell us about the factors that helped you lead the Phillies over the Dodgers in the 1983 NLCS after the Dodgers had given the Phillies such a thumping during the 1983 regular season? Gary Matthews.
Thanks, Dan. You know, I just want to touch a little bit on Dickie and being a teammate. He's one of the guys that really would protect you. But the fact is that he was coming up and in on everybody. It wasn't just going to be one soul because, you know, back then, the Dodgers actually used to fine their pitchers if they had an 0-2 count and someone got a hit, they would fine a guy for that, meaning that they wanted that pitch to be up and in. But Dickie had a reputation in the league that he would actually do that. So when I saw that happen, I mean, I wasn't surprised at all that he had knocked a guy down. I was only surprised that it wasn't more. And like he said, if he had probably been in there, you know, it would have been. But, you know, back then there too, that was a thing of more of intimidation. And you had guys like Goose Gossage that was out there, and along with, for me, Mr. Lee, that nobody actually talks about, which I think is one of the better closers that the Cubs have ever had. And it's not, again, and you guys are stat people, which, you know, don't get me wrong on this statement, is that for me, I'm not a stat guy in terms of evaluating a player on from where I've come from. I look at the heart and whether or not I can go to battle with a guy, whether or not it's a pitcher, whether or not it's an everyday player like one of my best friends, Gary Maddox, Steve Carlton. There was a reason why we called that Win Day. I learned to really respect John Denny because, again, for me, I didn't have a lot of pitchers that were really friends. But I do know one thing. With the guys that I have played with, and particularly Steve Carlton and also John Denny from the starting standpoint, because really that up-and-in pitch, and guys complain today, I would get that once in at bat. And if I wasn't, that means that I really weren't really doing my job, because that means I wasn't hitting the ball, so I became really an easy out. I would get hit, and Denny or Carlton, they wouldn't hit one guy, they would hit two guys. But they also had the ability to be able to strike guys out. So I just wanted to say that about Dickie. And, you know, again, he's one of those guys for me, too, that easily I could be in the foxhole because, again, he's the type of guy, and he said it really low, and a lot of people didn't hear that about, you know, the ballroom brawl or so on. Let me tell you, don't look for this guy here to quit from the playing field or the bars, although he's not in those anymore. He was a great teammate and also a protector, so I just wanted to really get that out. And he knows that without me even saying it because we've been friends, you know, a long time. And, you know, I faced him, which really wasn't fun, and we would have battles. And that's the one thing I think I miss the most on the field is just that one-on-one competition, that battle. And I was one of the ones, I didn't want to be 2-0 or 3-0. I wanted it to be more like 2-2 and 3-2 to really kind of give that pitcher a chance. Because if he didn't hang that slider, he was going to be in some deep, deep stuff. Let me just say that. But going back to 83, the Los Angeles Dodgers was the nemesis of the Philadelphia Phillies, keeping them out twice from being in the World Series for whatever reason. Growing up in Los Angeles and coming up with the Giants, it was always, for me, a hatred for the Los Angeles Dodgers, in particular Tommy Lasorda and bleeding the Dodger blue. So in 83, after they had just really beat us the whole year, I had called Dusty Baker, another one of my best friends, and I told him I was feeling good and that I was going to be the MVP of the series. And he looked at me and said, oh, no, you're not. So in the meeting, he actually went to Jerry Royce and said, hey, listen, I don't think you ought to be throwing this guy strikes. Well, Royce had a lot of pride himself, and another pitcher that would just battle you. He, again, you can remember these things like it was happened yesterday. The first pitch with two men on, he actually threw was down near my legs where I kind of jumped out of the way. And the next pitch he threw, or the second one, was in our old stadium there up near the upper deck. And it was the loudest sound. And I didn't even look at the ball. I turned around and asked Steve Yeager because I had, on the backswing, I had hit him in the glove. And again, we had gone through a whole lot of battles and simply said, hey, take that. And then threw the bat down and ran around the bases there. And I can instantly see, because I wanted to, Tom Lasorda, as he had his head down too. But you know, getting in there and playing against the Dodgers for me was something that I'll never forget. And especially being here in Philadelphia, where they're different fans than they are around the country. Their passion is a little different because after getting used to winning, they always demanded excellence. And especially from whatever players that they would be, that they would be their so-called super players, whether or not it was in basketball, football, hockey, and in baseball there back in the 80s. And Mike Smith would say it all the time. There was a guy in Veterans Stadium that used to boo Mike unmercifully, even before he got the pine tar on the bat. And Mike could hear him. He would never really look over, but he would always say, if he didn't have any hits on the road, oh, man, I'm getting ready to hear those boos from this guy. And even the true player and the best player I've had to be able to hit behind me, because he would really just make that guy throw me nothing but fastballs, and I appreciate that with Mike to this day. Without a doubt, I really realized kind of what baseball was all about once coming to Philadelphia, because the other places I played, the Giants and also the Braves, we were losing there, and really nobody in the ballpark. So coming to Philly was really refreshing and also easy at the same time, because we had other players that really, they didn't look upon me to do really anything. I thought that was just great. Pete Rose there on the team, Tony Perez, Michael Jack, my best friend Gary Maddox. I thought this is the way, you know, it should be. You know, all of a sudden it wasn't like, hey, come on now, Matt, pick us up. It was like, man, they're booing Mike. They're not booing me. He's the one that's got to hit, you know, the home runs. But coming here and then really learning, too, how important baseball, how important the walks were, the percentage of that, learning that from Mike and also along with Pete Rose. The passion that those guys had on a daily basis really go out. I mean, you just want to play even harder. So for me, I don't know how the other guys felt, but for me it was really a pleasure to be able to come here to Philadelphia to be able to play, because they, Blue Collar City, appreciate just hard playing. I'll preface that by saying after the first couple of weeks, because they really felt I was traded for Greg Luzinski, and it was not the case. Even though not hitting the first couple of weeks, I end up getting booed. But again, that's the Philadelphia way. That's kind of like they're welcoming you into their particular city. But if you're a smart guy, you're able to have that where you don't really thrive on the boos, but it makes you play better. It makes you more determined if you can look at it that way. Because Dallas Green would always say, you know, it's that player. It's up to that player to go out there and play. And he's another, obviously, one of my favorites. And even after getting me to the Cubs, I asked him, what took you so long? But the Philadelphia fans, and in particular, 1983 for me was a year that I'll never really forget, almost kind of really putting me, you know, on the map, and certainly as a player, really realizing how important winning really is, and really glad to be a part of it. So, again, having killed those Dodgers, if I had to do it all over again, I would have hit more home runs against those guys.
Gary Matthews! Of course, Gary is now a beloved member of the Phillies broadcast team. You can see him on all Phillies telecasts, and he brings his keen insight, knowledge, a sense of humor, and frankness. He will discuss the game. He knows that you can't compliment everybody. Everybody doesn't deserve a compliment every game. And Gary will offer constructive criticism, but he does it in a way that is not offensive, and I think that's important, too. And we're so glad to have you, Gary, in Philadelphia. Beyond your playing career, and you were terrific, we're glad to have you as a very important member of the Phillies broadcast team. And by the way, Dickie Knowles is our employee assistance professional, and maybe we'll get Dickie to tell you a little bit about that if we have enough time. The third member of our panel, one of the great gentlemen in Phillies history, and man, oh man, you don't have many better seasons than Brad Lidge had in 2008. Brad, I wonder if you could please tell us a little bit about your feelings, the team's feelings, Game 5 of the 2008 Phillies of the 2008 World Series, which the Phillies won. Of course, the Phillies are leading 3-1, but remember, it was played in two parts. And I think to a man, whether you were a player on the team, whether you were the manager, the coach, a broadcaster, a front office person, you thought the Phillies were going to win that game. And then we almost felt like something got taken from us. But Brad, if you could tell us how you felt, how the team felt, and then maybe if you could walk us through that last inning when you had that memorable strikeout of Eric Hinsky and the Phillies became world champions of baseball. Brad Lidge.
All right. Well, first, I just want to say, listening to Sergeant Dickey, man, the game's changed a lot. Just from the simple fact that, you know, if you're an intimidator like Dickey was, or like Goose Gossage, who, by the way, was number 54, and that's why I always kept my jersey number 54. Somebody was asking me earlier, why'd you stick with 54 when I first was given that number? But when I found out that Goose Gossage had that number, plus I had this weird superstitious thing in Houston in the minor leagues. I had the number 20. And every time I got to 20 innings, I mean, to the inning, I would break down and get hurt somehow. And it was like three years in a row. But somehow I kept advancing through the system, got a big league spring training invite, and they gave me number 54. And I thought, that's almost 2.5 times more innings. Or it's more than 2.5 times more innings. So I thought that was pretty good. And then when I found out Goose had that number, I knew I wasn't changing it. But anyway, you know, just listening to him talk about the intimidation factor back then, and being able to pitch in to guys and telling them, you know, I'm gonna hit you in the head and everything else, and the umpire's just saying, play ball, you know, like that's all good. But because nowadays people are, you know, where the game's changed, I think one of the big ways is how sensitive. Maybe the hitters are, I should say, but how sensitive everybody is out there. There's, you know, if you throw at a guy's head, it's a warning if you get anywhere close. So pitching's a little different, but I always thought, man, I would have loved to have played back in those days, just being able to really get after guys, you know, if you gave you a bad look, throwing at his head, and it's all good, it's baseball. I wish a lot of that was still intact today, but those are pretty awesome stories to hear. And pretty cool that to hear those memories from you guys. That's a lot of fun. But you know, so going back to 2008, you know, I think the season obviously had unfolded in a way that put us in a situation where we felt extremely confident going into that World Series. And I'll just say this: I think after the World Series was over, I remember Charlie Manuel saying, we could have played another 100 games at the end of the season that year, just tacked them on and won just about every single one of them, because we were just steamrolling at that point. And I think, you know, firing on all cylinders, the confidence we had was awesome. And it was amazing to be a part of that team where so many guys, all-star caliber guys, everyone was just playing together in a way that was just allowing us to get better and better, it seemed, in September and then in the division series and the championship series. And so I felt like going into the World Series, you know, we had a really good chance to win this thing. And for me personally, and I'm sure for everybody on the team, but for me personally, to be able to be back there and have another opportunity, I had an opportunity in Houston to win one, but I didn't pitch well, the team didn't play well, and to get another opportunity at that point was pretty special, and I didn't want to let it go. I mean, especially, you know, this was the year, everything was right, and we had to make this work, and you know, I think, so anyway, going into that series, there was just a ton of confidence and guys really wanting it. We had that early lead over Tampa in the series. We came back to Philly. It's 1-1, one game to one game. And we even had a game at home where we blew them out a little bit. And that doesn't happen very often in World Series games where you actually blow another team out. But I think going into Game 5, we knew we needed to lock it down in Philly. It needed to happen here. And everyone felt like it was going to happen. But, of course, the elements come in as they do in Philadelphia, and it was freezing cold, and it was pouring rain. And, I mean, I remember, so as a closer, one of the luxuries you have as a closer is you get to be in the clubhouse for the first few innings, kind of pampering yourself. Some guys call it a little, you know, day spa treatment. We go in the hot tub, get stretched out, stuff like that. So, you know, it's a fairly nice position to be in. It's good work if you can get it. But I'm inside with JC Romero and some other guys, and you know, we're really we're looking at the weather on TV. We're watching the game, of course, when we're in there, and it is pouring. And you can start to see there's puddles that are happening in the infield. And it's, you know, you see people, you can see the breath coming out of their mouth, and you can see everyone shaking out there. Everyone's wearing serious, you know, two or three layers out there. And, you know, we're just saying, maybe you ought to stay in here an extra half inning tonight. It looks nasty out there. You know, we're getting ready, but at the same time, you know, we keep asking the ground crews guys who come in every once in a while, we say, you know, what's it going to be like? Is it going to keep doing this? And he's like, man, he's like, I don't know how they started this game. I don't know how they're continuing to play this game. And, you know, Cole Hamels is on the mound, and he's doing an outstanding job for us. And we're winning 1-0. And the game keeps going, and it keeps going, and it's getting worse and worse. And finally, it's the fourth or fifth inning, and I got to get out there. And so I get down to the bullpen, and I'm you know, put my hand out, and I'm like, this is crazy. You know, there's games you play in that are cold, and that's fine. We know how to deal with that. And there's games that you play in where it's raining, and that's fine. You know, we know how to deal with that too. But when it's this cold and raining this much, it seems you know, a little awkward for this game to be continuing. And it's the World Series. You don't want to stop it for anything. I get that. But these elements were stacked up pretty high. And so, of course, it's Bud Selig's call. You know, what's he going to do? The game keeps progressing. There's just when players are running from base to base, you see water splashing everywhere. And so I go out and I tell Mick out there down in the bullpen, I was like, listen, I need to just play catch, see how my grip is on my pitches tonight out there. And, you know, we have ways of making sure we can get a grip on certain pitches in the elements, like I said, whether it's cold or whether it's rainy. But it was so cold and slick out there, I fired some fastballs at him, just had him standing up, and I said, slider, just wanted to see how I felt. First one I threw out of my hand went up into the stands. And I was like, oh, man, this is not good. So I get some more rosin, I'm rubbing my hands, trying to figure out a way, putting them in front of the butane tank down there, trying to heat it up. It gets a little stick to it. I'm doing everything I can to try and get a grip on the ball. The second one, I throw him, goes about 40 feet, bounces up into his chest, and he just kind of shakes his head, throws it back at me, and he's like, maybe you should just wait till you warm up for the game. He's like, just can it for now. Maybe it'll be better later. And I realized at that point right there, I was like, man, I'm going to have to come up with something out there because I don't know if I'll have my best slider tonight. And, you know, lo and behold, the elements kept coming. It kept raining, kept getting colder, and Tampa actually ended up scoring another run. And I think that was the point where Selig and MLB kind of decided, okay, it's knotted up 1-1. Let's call this thing. No one's feelings are going to get hurt because no one's winning, so we can continue the game. So we were a little frustrated at that point for a lot of reasons as a team, I think. But so the game ends, and we go into this crazy continuation game, right? It's like a shotgun start. I mean, it's 1-1. It almost felt like sudden death, although there was still three innings left to play. So the game happens. We get started the next night, and we're playing well. I think Jenkins hits that double. Burl hits a double. We're ahead 3-1, and they score a run, too. I think it's 3-2. Going into the ninth inning, so I got a one run. Am I wrong? Was that the right score? 3-2. I'm pretty sure that was. I know it was a one run game, but I'm warming up, and the next night I'm feeling a lot better about things because it's drier, thank God, and I've got a grip on my slider, and I know that that at this point tonight's going to be the night. I felt it warming up, and 2008 was a year where we were talking a little bit about it, but you. The way the season played out for me, it wasn't just that I pitched well. I mean, I pitched the best I'd ever pitched in my life. But in order to have a year like that, you have to have great defense. You have to have everything around you go right. And there were two plays in particular I remember that that allowed the season to remain perfect up to that point. There was a game in Atlanta where Shane Victorino threw out a guy scoring at home plate. And it was a one-run lead. And it was a perfect throw, one hopper to Chooch. To end the game, it was the third out of the ninth inning. We had a one-run lead, and there was a hit to center field, and that guy would have scored, would have tied the game, but Victorino threw him out at home plate. And that was point number one that really sticks out in my mind about the season. The second one was the day we clinched the NL East in Philadelphia, and Jimmy Rollins, we have the bases loaded, also one-run game, and Ryan Zimmerman's up in Washington. And Washington's been hitting a little bit better, and I'm out there, and like I said, the bases were loaded, and I think I had a full count on Zimmerman, and I threw him a full count slider. It was a good pitch down in the zone, and he hits it pretty well, and it's kind of going off to the right side of the mound for me as I'm looking at home plate, and I turn around. There's nothing I can do. I wasn't the most athletic fielding pitcher anyway. So I'm kind of watching this ball dribble by me, and I'm thinking, oh, no, this thing's going up the middle. Out of nowhere, Jimmy dives, sticks this ball, grabs it, flips it to Chase, who's in super fast forward motion, and throws the guy out at first base for a double play to end the game. And needless to say, I ran out and gave him a, you know, we clinched the NL East. It was just, it was amazing. And I think from that point forward, I didn't just feel like I was pitching my best. I didn't just feel like we had incredible defense when I was pitching, but I felt like literally that no matter what happened out there, things were going to go the right way. It was meant to be. I could just feel it when I was pitching, and that's something a baseball player doesn't get very often. But I really, at that point, just felt like everything was going to work no matter what. So I'm warming up to go into the ninth inning. Flashback forward to the last game there in the World Series. I'm warming up, and I feel really good. And I get out there to start the inning. And, you know, there's times where we have extra adrenaline, and then there's times where we have extra adrenaline. And that was it. That was for me getting out there with the fans standing up, you know, playing my song, running out of the bullpen. And I felt like I could run through a brick wall and literally not even feel it. And, you know, I'm running toward the mound and get up there. The warm-up pitches are going good. I'm feeling good. And, you know, the inning starts. And it starts off pretty good. I think Longoria got him to pop up. The next hitter is able to get a ground ball through the hole. And I believe it was Dionar Navarro, the catcher for Tampa. And he's on first base. And, they pinch run for him because that guy was not very fast. And when the next guy gets up, immediately Ben Zobrist, you know, I think probably they didn't need to tell that runner anything because I didn't really hold runners on very well. I really didn't care at all about base runners. If a guy got on base and he wanted to steal, go ahead. I'm going to strike out the next guy. So go ahead. Take second base. That's just kind of how I always felt about it. And I never, you know, people always try to work with me in spring training about getting better times, holding guys on and stuff. But and I do it just to appease them in spring training. As soon as the season rolled around, would never cross my mind. So they sent in their pinch runner, and first pitch, my knee goes up into my windup, he takes off. I knew it was going to happen, and he slides into second safe. I don't even think Chooch attempted to throw. He was long gone, and it was an easy steal for him. But now, you know, the reality is it's a one-run game in the World Series, bottom of the ninth inning, or top of the ninth inning, and the guy isn't scoring position, and there's one out. So I need to make sure that I do actually, you know, bear down here and focus back in. And a lot of people ask me before that game started, did you ever think about, you know, how you'd react or anything like that after the game? And I kept thinking, the biggest thing for me is I felt like if I was out of the moment, if I thought about too far into the future, then I might break this meant to be feeling that I had. And I didn't want to let myself ever get out of that feeling of being right in that moment and that focus of right in the moment. And so when he stole second, I kind of felt like it was just, okay, get bear down, get back to what you've been doing all year, throwing your slider for strikes, doing what you can do. Well, Zobrist ends up hitting a ball pretty darn well, a slider pretty well to Jason Worth in right field. And Worth comes running in and makes a pretty darn good catch. I don't think he really necessarily had to dive, but he made a great catch anyway, and Zobrist hit that ball pretty well. And this is, again, you have that feeling. Okay, he hits it right to Worth, and now there's two outs, and that runner's still on second base. And now there's not a doubt in my mind what's going to happen, but I've got to make sure that I actually make the pitches. Like, I know what's going to happen, but I can't let my mind get there yet. So Tampa Bay comes out, and they bring out Eric Hinsky, who's going to be a pinch hitter at this situation. Now, Hinsky had hit a home run off Joe Blanton early in the series, and off me personally, he had done pretty well. And so Rich Doobie came out of the dugout, came up to me, and he said, "All right, Lidgey, how are we going to pitch this guy?" Right? And I'm thinking, Doobie, I've faced this guy two or three times. And I don't think Doobie may have known my history against him, but I'd struck him out once on a slider, and the other two times I'd faced him, he hit line drives off the walls on fastballs. And I said, there's not a doubt in my mind, Dubes. We're going with a slider. I even told him, I said, this guy raked me on a fastball. I'm not throwing a fastball. And Chooch, you know, he said, okay, slider. And he got back down there and got back behind the plate. And, it was almost one of those deals where we knew the game plan as soon as Hinsky got. From that point forward, we knew exactly what we were going to do. We were going to throw a slider for a strike. and make him know that he's got to swing at the pitch. And then we weren't going to go back into the zone. We were going to go just work down, down each time and make him chase a little bit more, a little bit more. And so we got ahead of him. It was 0-1, then it was 1-1, then it was 1-2. And at this point, Chooch comes out. He comes back out to me and said, I know you want to throw a slider. Where do you want to throw it? And I said, Chooch, I said, don't put your fingers down. Just set up. Just go back there and just set up. You just put the glove where you want me to throw it, and I'm going to throw it there. And I think the first pitch, he fouled off. So it was 1-2. We had to do it again. And at this point, it's getting so crazy because every single pitch, the fans are anticipating the last out. And every single pitch, it's getting louder and louder, and the adrenaline is getting more and more. And I'm just thinking to myself, keep executing, keep executing. Don't let everything come into your mind. But at the same time, you'd have to be crazy not to let it in a little bit. I mean, I felt that extra adrenaline surge because of how loud everybody was, because of, you know, knowing what's at stake, but blocking it out, it's still in your mind. And again, Chooch calls a slider. At this point, I remember coming set on this last one, and I gripped the pitch. And for some reason, as soon as I gripped it in my glove, I felt the seams in my fingers, and I was like, this is the one. This is the one that's going to end it right here. I knew before, you know, right when I gripped it. And went into the windup, reared back, and let it eat, and threw it as hard as I could, but stayed in control and in the mechanics, which I didn't often do. But I did on that pitch. And, I could see it coming out of my hand. I could feel it. I could see the break on the pitch, and I could see that he was starting to swing. And I knew right there he was going to miss it because of his swing path and the way the ball was headed. And it went down. He swung and missed. And Chooch jumped up. And I think I jumped up and then went down to my knees. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, we just won the World Series. And then all of a sudden, the next thing I know, I'm on my head with my knee somehow up by my head. And about a lot of very large human beings jumping on my back. And, Chooch and I are at the bottom. I'm still, like, on top of him, kind of. And we're still, like, his face mask is pressed against my face. And we're still going, yeah, yeah, like, to each other. But neither of us can really breathe. And, we're on top. And of course, when I watch the replays, you see Shane Victorino jumping on top and then running off and then jumping on top again. And it was, it was one of those deals where you can't feel any pain. I mean, it doesn't matter what position you're in. It doesn't matter if you can breathe or not. You're still screaming. And it was quite a special moment in my life and obviously in my career. I still get goosebumps thinking about it kind of going through everything. You know, sometimes when I remember it, I think of the perspective from watching it on TV. But then on that last pitch, always I can put myself back in my mindset. Back what I need to think about and feeling the grip of that pitch. And it's a pretty amazing thing, but it's something I'll obviously keep replaying in my mind for as long as I can remember. But that's why I'm retiring a Philly for that moment. And it's a pretty special time.
Phillies pitcher number 54, Brad Lidge. Now, Brad and Carlos Ruiz are going to do a reenactment of that last pitch tonight. Brad, are you going down on your knees? You know, like you
right? I haven't heard that. That's news to me.
It's going to be great. How many are coming to the Phillies-Giants game tonight? Well, listen, more of you have to come. We got some great baseball down there, and it's a wonderful stadium, wonderful ballpark. Want to welcome Paige, Gary Matthews' daughter, right here in the front row. And Paige, sleeping. Thank you for joining us today. Stand up, honey.
Sleeping.
Paige Matthews.
What a great name.
Also, Philadelphia is home to the greatest track carnival in the world, the world-famous Penn Relays. And a member of Sabre is the director of the Penn Relays, Dave Johnson. Dave Johnson is here. I also want to acknowledge Jim Van Koski out of Delaware County and Chester High School. Jim was the moving force behind having a statue of Mickey Vernon built in Marcus Hook. And Jim Van Koski also started the Mickey Vernon Museum. Which is located out in the Granite Run Mall in Delaware County. So I don't know if I saw Jim before this panel discussion. I don't know if he's still here, but he does great things for this area and for Delaware County baseball. So thank you to Jim Van Koski. Now, we have until 1:45. We have about 20 minutes. If anybody has a question, we will entertain those questions at this time. I would ask if you would please state your name and your hometown, and then ask your question and tell us to whom the question is directed. Go ahead, sir.
Howie Siegel, Brooklyn, Los Angeles, and Victoria, British Columbia. My address is towards Sarge Gary Matthews. I want to take you back to that 1983 championship series against the Dodgers at Chavez Ravine. I was in the left field bleachers with Joel Schwartz sitting right over there. And the talk in LA was that you were a platoon player. You hit 50 points less that season, 244 against righties, as opposed to 294 against lefties. I think you had Von Hayes on that team, Greg Gross. So we had decided, Joel and I, in the left field bleachers, that you were, in fact, a platoon player. And
that's
during
okay.
the warm-ups before the game, when you were out in left field taking your throws, I let you know it at the top of my voice. Matthews, you're a platoon player. You can't hit righties. This was my contribution to the Dodgers' effort to defeat the Phillies. I figured that if I destroyed you psychologically...
Yeah. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Do you have a question?
Be patient. Good things...
Security.
Good things take a while to arrive. I destroyed you. I thought psychologically. You glared at me. Whether you remember that or not, you glared directly at me. I had a big mouth. I had a big mouth when I was younger.
There were a lot of those
you
in Philadelphia.
You destroyed us that series. You hit three homers, eight RBIs. You're not a platoon player, Gary Matthews.
Thank you very much. Now, just to really kind of reiterate on that, that particular year, it was a year where, I mean, even Pete Rose, if you remember that year, was benched during the World Series. That was very hard for him to take. But no one on our team really had a good year that year. I think even looking back on it, one of my worst years, I had hit 258 and led the team in hitting that year. Although, again, guys, remember the name of the game is to be able to win. And that same year, Denny was the Cy Young Award winner for sure. So, you know, if I had to go and look at my career, I would have it the same way because of getting into the World Series, without a doubt, you want to win, but to be able to get there, for most players, that's like a dream come true. So I would have it really the same way. I must have been striking out a lot that year.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for those remarks. I was only trying to move you along in hopes that we could accommodate all of the folks who might have a question. Please, sir.
Justin Klug from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Brad Lidge, I wanted to ask you a question. One of your post-Phillies years, you got picked up by the Nationals, and you were quoted as saying at that point they were probably the best team you'd ever been a part of. So I was wondering how strong of brainwashing techniques the Washington Nationals front office imparts on you, how much of an emotional toll that has on you as a player to have to be forced to say something like that?
Well, first, let's make sure we get the quote right. I said it was the most talented team that I had been with and when I was in Washington. And that was true, but keep in mind there's a separation here, and I'll address that in a second, but the separation is the best team versus the most talented team. And that's why I was very careful to choose my words, because I knew it might come off the wrong way if I didn't. But that spring training was a pretty impressive spring training with the Washington Nationals. They did have literally... You know, so Jason Worth, keep in mind, was a guy during batting practice that could always hit the ball farther than anybody else with the Phillies. And he would do it in batting practice routinely. He goes to Washington, and he goes to about fifth or sixth in line there. They've got guys hitting balls 500 feet, 450 feet in batting practice routinely. They got guys throwing 97 everywhere. Gio Gonzalez comes in. Strasburg's there. Guys in the bullpen are all throwing close to 100. So I looked around at the talent. I said, this is the most talent I've ever seen on a team. And it really was. It was amazing. But the separation there of the best team versus the most talented team is a big separation. Again, 2008 will always be the best team I ever played on, no doubt about it. But the most talent, it was pretty impressive. And I think if you have a good baseball eye, I'm assuming probably most of you guys know the game pretty well, you'd probably come to the same conclusion. But again, talent doesn't mean anything unless you're able to translate it onto the field. And the Nationals last year, my only year with them, were able to get to the postseason. It didn't translate in the postseason, and this year it hasn't translated so far for them either. So there you go with the talent. But there was no brainwashing that I know of, but it could have... They did want me to make a few statements. I will say they wanted me to make a few statements that I brushed aside and said, I still got family living in Philly, man. You're crazy. But that's about where that ended.
Thank you, Brad. Next, sir.
Jim Satterley, DeLand, Florida. My question for Brad. A lot of people in the sabermetric community believe that a team's best relief pitcher should be used in the seventh or eighth inning whenever the situation is the most critical. And I was wondering if you could address the difference, perhaps involving the emotional and psychological differences between pitching in the seventh and the ninth inning.
Well, that's a great question for if you guys didn't hear that, because that's been debated a lot in baseball, especially recently, about when to use your closer or the most valuable reliever in your bullpen. Do you want to always use them in the ninth, or do you want them out there maybe earlier in the game in the seventh or eighth? And I think that one of the reasons, besides managers feeling like they're going to be chastised by the media for getting people out of their normal roles and doing something different. Baseball tradition dies hard, as everybody's aware of. But one of the reasons besides that, I believe, is because guys have a tendency, even though the situation may be on the line, the game might be on the line in the seventh or eighth inning, but bullpen pitchers have a tendency, and Dick, you can also address this, to get comfortable in your roles and where you're going to pitch and knowing how to prepare for that inning. And so if I know I'm throwing the ninth inning, I can do whatever I need to do during the game to mentally and physically prepare to pitch in the ninth inning. Now, other guys have different roles where they might be throwing various innings, but they know to be ready at certain times. And I think that mental and physical preparation goes a long ways. So I think guys in general prefer to know when and where they're going to pitch. And I think that's kind of why managers don't want to mess with it, because they know that bullpen guy might be planning physically and mentally to throw a certain time. And Dickie, I don't know if you, I mean.
Well, the bottom line is not everybody can pitch the ninth inning. I mean, that's the truth. Stuff-wise, you know, people were talking about the kid that closed for San Francisco, and he had a lot of enthusiasm, didn't have Brad Lidge stuff, let's just say that. He used different pitches, but he was precise with his pitches. Some guys say they can do it, but most guys can. It's you got to have the guts and the stuff to do it, and that's why you have got the ninth inning becomes a little different inning. If you're facing Gary Matthews in the first inning, you facing midnight, then it's a whole different ball game, because in the ninth inning, if you come in like he talked about, he's going to spit at you, trust me, and he's going to get closer to home plate, and he's going to become a better hitter. And Sarge was a better hitter, as good as hitter in the ninth inning as anybody I've played with, him and Pete Rose. But the thing is, a hitter will tell you they're better in the ninth inning with men on base than they are in the seventh inning or the sixth inning or the fifth inning, because there's no tomorrow. And I believe that the special guys close games because they've proven it, that they can do it mentally and, as Brad said, and physically.
Hey, could you explain that spit thing you were talking about, please?
Real quick, I threw at Sarge one time too, so you know I fired up and in at Sarge and I was going to hit him in my third baseman at the time. Wasn't Mike Smith? Mike was John Vukovich, who was playing for Smith. He said, "Don't hit him, please." I said, "Why not?" He just spit at me. He goes, "Because then he's going to come out and hit you in the mouth with his fist." He looks like a wonderful guy. And Paige, I'm telling you, he's one of my favorite people in the world, but this is one of the meanest suckers you ever played with. And he spit at me after I came up and in on him and then stood on home plate.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Norm King. I'm from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I'm a little disappointed that Mike Schmidt isn't on the panel, because I wanted to personally thank him for that home run he hit off Stan Bonson in 1980 that led you guys to the playoffs and knocked the Expos out of the pennant race. If you're not here, but anyway, Mike, thanks very much. I have a two-part question. My first question is to Brad and Dickie, and that is, What do you guys, do you think that managers rely too much on pitch counts these days? And my second question is to Gary, and I wanted to ask you, where did you get that really neat hat?
Well,
let me go with that one first,
yeah,
because
take that, Sarge.
It'll take them a little while. Mine is simple. I have my own website, sargeshats.com, so I haven't paid for any hat. I didn't really mean, Dan, to get a plug in here. I mean, it was going to be something else, but yes. Matter of fact, now that my daughter's here, she's going to be getting her own hats because I'm launching some kids for Dora. So who better to try it out than your own daughter that will say, oh, no, that doesn't look good. Oh, no, I don't want that one. But we're going to have those, though, for sure.
As you exit this panel discussion, there is a concession just outside of Salon E.
Well, I think I should get a freebie because I gave him a chance for a free...
free promo right there. Those hats are looking better every day of retirement, I'll tell you what. Pitch count, real quick. For me, I think that it's become too big of a deal, I think. But at the same time, I almost feel like, you know, watching the last couple no-hitters and watching guys have a rough go after that, guys are getting injured after that, you know, their pitch counts get up in the 140. There's something about if a guy is training to throw no more than 125, 130 pitches, and then all of a sudden he's able to go about 148 or whatever it has to be for a no-hitter, then he does end up having a little bit of collateral damage. And I'm not really sure what the deal is. I think it's because we don't train the same way that guys used to do. And I think that if we did, the pitch count wouldn't be as big of a deal. But it's guys are getting paid so much right now, everyone seems scared to go up to that pitch count, and all of a sudden a guy gets injured and it all comes back to the manager or the pitching coach saying, what are you doing? You knew his pitch count was too high. So I think it's more that people are scared to push the people that are getting paid a lot of money into that unknown, uncharted territory where they might get injured. What do you think, Diggy?
I think you hit it right on the head. I think that's perfect. Guys are programmed. And I don't think guys throw as much today. I know Nolan Ryan over in Texas was trying to increase their pitch counts. We didn't have pitch counts. Nobody, you know, a difference is in spring training now. These guys have pitch counts from the time they warm up to the time they quit warming up and when they throw their five-minute session of BP. And ours was a little different. We would warm up for 15 minutes, throw batting practice for 15 minutes in spring training. And our batting practice was, I never forget it, they said it's for your legs, it's for the hitter, it's just to get yourself the rhythm going, and you shouldn't throw too many pitches by guys. Then when you come back, you throw another 15 minutes maybe in the bullpen to work on pitches. So nobody was sitting there counting your pitches. It was when you feel like you've had enough. And they had an idea. I mean, they didn't just let you throw all day long. I also think Sandlot baseball has a lot to do with it. Guys today want to go out and play baseball. We grew up, Sarge, I know you did it. I did it. I had number 24 on my back out playing ball every day, or number 14 or 7 or 41 for Seaver. And we threw to each other. We played pickle. We threw baseballs all day long. And kids that are now, they go to a batting cage or they're on a mound somewhere in an organized instructional pitching clinic compared to the way they used to grow up and throw quite a bit. I think that has a lot to it. And your manager screwed that up by letting Schmidt hit that home run. Don McCormick was on deck. So you need to go back and tell your manager, walk Schmidt.
Okay, we've got about 10 more
Thank
minutes.
You very much.
We got about 10 more minutes. So if we can expedite the process, perhaps we can accommodate everyone. Thank
All
you.
Right, I'll be quick. Steve Ferencik, Wynwood, Pennsylvania. Both a question for Brad and also a comment. I was there, lucky enough to be there for Game 5 in 2008, so one of the great moments of my life. Also, I was there in Game 5 of 2009, which wasn't as great, but I wanted to ask you, you had the out slider that everyone would talk about, and bouncing the dirt, hitter would think it was a strike, swing at it, that's what got Hinsky out. When Johnny Damon got to third base on that, and then everyone started talking, now that took away Brad's out slider. And I was wondering, what was your thought process? Did you say, you know what, Chooch is fast enough to get over there and stop it if it bounces? Were you confident in that, or were the coaches telling you not to do it then?
Well, here's the deal. I was confident in Chooch. I don't know if it affected our pitch selection because A-Rod was up, and normally I'd be throwing him a lot of sliders. When I have in the past, I've had success. We went fastball in, first pitch, took it. Fastball in, second pitch, you got a hit. I don't know. Looking back, of course, you know, it would have been, we should have just taken our chances maybe with the sliders. But, you know, Damon did, he did a hell of a job on that base running, getting to third base, and he put the heat on a little bit, and it did make it tougher. So me personally, I still felt like if he was going to put down a slider, I was going to throw it. I didn't have any reason to hold anything back. I totally trusted that Chooch could block it. But I don't know if that affected his idea maybe. I don't know. I haven't really talked to him about that, to be honest. We don't like to bring up bad memories too much.
And my suggestion is you have a great speaking manner here, and I think it would be a good advice for you to consider following guys like Tug McGraw, like Mitch Williams, like Gary Matthews, like Reggie Ashburn, and look for some sort of broadcasting job around Philadelphia.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sounds good.
Might do it.
Please.
Hi, my name is Joe Daly from Marlton, New Jersey, born and raised in Philadelphia. First, just a comment for Brad. Thank you for 2008. If it wasn't for the Phillies that year, this 2013 would be the 30th anniversary of no championships in this city. So thank you for that. My question is, there was a kicker in the NFL, Gary Anderson, who was perfect in the regular season and then missed a short field goal and cost the Vikings the playoffs. Towards the end of that year, did it ever occur to you that, hey, it wouldn't be the worst thing if I blew a save and didn't have that hanging over my head?
You know, honestly, I was able, for me, I felt very good about the way I was able to put that off. Because I'm telling you, you have that question. 100 people have that question for me in the media every single day. You know, they would bring it up every day. Well, you know, wouldn't it be a crime to go this far perfect in the season and then blow it in the World Series? You know, they wanted to ask me that question just about every single day. So I would appease them and say, yeah, it would be a crime, but I'm not really thinking about that right now. And the truth was, once I started warming up, I didn't. You know, whether I had thought about it at all before then, I mean, sometimes you're like, you know, if thought enters your mind, you're like, okay, just push it out. It's not going to happen. You know, remember, the season's meant to be. But once I started warming up on the mound, really, my mind went into that same focus I'd had all year. So it never, the streak or the situation never really occurred to me or crossed my mind at all after I started warming up. But, you know, we've got a lot of nerves before we start warming up, and we're pacing down there and everything else, so everything crosses our mind at those points. But once that switch is flipped and we get on the mound and we start throwing, and Dickie will attest to the same thing, you get into a zone and a rhythm, and all of a sudden your body just starts taking over and your mind is processing and focusing, and you're not thinking about the peripheral things. I did have that question quite a bit. Thank God it went the right way.
Yes, thank you.
You bet.
Hi, Mike Bates from Madison, Wisconsin, and as a Vikings fan, thanks for that reminder. Brad, you had one of the most devastating and sharp-breaking sliders of anybody in recent history, and I wanted to know a little bit more about how you developed that pitch and what you think made it so effective.
First, thank you for that. I honestly, I was by default. When I pitched at Notre Dame in college, I threw a curveball. I was a starter. I got to the minor leagues in Houston, and as I mentioned, got hurt every time I got to 20 innings. Eventually, the minor league pitching coordinator, a guy named Dewey Robinson, who without a doubt has credit for giving me the slider, he said, listen, you got to get your hand away from your head, and you got to stop throwing a curveball because it's killing your elbow. So he changed my mechanics a little bit, and he showed me the grip on the slider, and he said, now when you throw this thing, don't worry about what the break's doing. Just throw it as hard as you can. So I learned to throw it as hard as I could first. And then once I got the feel for it, I was able to develop the break on it. And it took me several years in my career before I was able to start really locating it the way I wanted to. And fortunately, in 2008 in Philly, at that point, I felt like I could throw it anywhere I wanted, whenever I wanted, and change the variety of break on it. So it became a pitch for me that was absolutely instrumental in my career. I mean, without it, I would not have been anywhere close to my career the way it was. But Dewey Robinson in the minor leagues taught me it, and it was because I kept getting hurt throwing the curveball. That's basically as quick as best I can answer that.
Thanks very much.
That was an excellent question. Thank you.
It's also for Brad, Eric Van from Watertown, Mass. Maybe the most impressive pitching performance I can ever remember seeing was your 2005 All-Star appearance, striking out the side on 11 pitches, I think 9 swings and misses. However, it took place in a little box on the screen without commentary at all. I don't think they had even identified you by name because they were interviewing Kenny Rogers over some controversy that I've forgotten. My question is, if I was literally screaming obscenities at the broadcast crew, what was your reaction like when you discovered that like, they hadn't been paying attention to that?
That's a good question because so after the game, you know, I came in and Clemens was in the clubhouse. He had just thrown and he's like, "Did you throw?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "You didn't see it?" And he was just like the seventh inning or something. He was changing the shower. He's like, "No, man, they were doing something else when you were pitching." I was like, "What?" I was like, "That's the best inning I've ever had in my career. Nobody saw it." And I remember, you know, my mom and dad were there and everything else, and they were actually there, so they saw it. But all my friends were like, "Dude, you got screwed, man. We were watching the game, and no one even saw it." They're like, "It looked like you threw good, but we couldn't even see. We had a small TV." And I was like, "Oh, man." So, you know, I had to go back and watch it, and sure enough, just like you said, that was frustrating.
I had a 55-inch TV, so I could see what was going on, but it's like, most people can't even see this.
Yeah, they do that. They take breaks in the All-Star game and interview people. They did it when Jason Grilley was just pitching, and then this last one, which was kind of frustrating. I wanted to watch him pitch a little more.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but we're going to have to make this our last question.
Hi, I'm Jeff English from Pensacola, Florida. Kevin Soche is a hometown hero for us. My question is for Gary. You came up in 72 with the Giants, and in the late 60s, early 70s, as an organization, they were great at identifying talent, but not necessarily at developing and reaping the benefits from it, whether it was Bobby Bonds or Kingman or yourself or Chris Spire or some of those guys. Have you ever given much thought to what you guys might have been capable of if they had kept you guys together?
That's a pretty good question there, although if you remember back then, Willie Mays was on his way out. Gary Maddox took over that position there in center field. And if you can remember back then, they were putting together that big red machine. I've always, you know, and thought about those particular times. That was a difficult team to actually beat. And you're right, we did have a lot of outfielders because George Foster was actually traded over there to that Cincinnati Reds. But, you know, those guys, everybody in the lineup hit 300, including Geronimo, and the guys that didn't like Tony Perez rather hit 300, but also like 30 driving in 100 and scoring 100. For me, regardless if they kept us together or not, I don't think we would have been able to beat those guys. Marischal was gone. We had traded Gaylord Perry for McDowell. That did not work out. And again, those guys with the big red machine, they were awful good. Hitting wise, they just beat you up, played good defense. And like I said, everybody in the lineup hit 300 those years there. So they beat our pitchers up. It wasn't a fun time there early on. It really wasn't.
Thank you.
You have been a wonderful audience. How about a standing ovation for these Phillies postseason heroes? Number 48, Dickie Knowles. Number 34, Gary Matthews. And number 54, Brad Lidge. Thank you, everybody. Have a great time in Philadelphia.
You know what? I don't want to start signing because I'm going to be here too long.